when I search for something to describe what's going on today, disarray is the word I've chosen. You're going to see that several times if you look at what I'm talking about this whole year, because it's the best description I know of how do I look at things today. This scripture in Isaiah is an important one. I'll come back to it in just a minute because it's really what gave me the idea for this kind of a discussion. But first, I brought love yesterday. I want to show you those that are sending you love. This is our family. Of course, you know, recognize Gretchen and I in the middle. Our son Aaron and our daughter Rachel send love. We are a very close family, and our unfortunate thing is we can't talk as much as we usually do when we're here in Australia, but they send special love to you. We have the privilege of meeting with two different classes in the United States. One, our primary class, the Delaware Valley class, which is on the east coast of the United States in Philadelphia. We are about an hour and a half from New York City. We are about 2.5 hours from Washington, D.C. So we're right in that corridor. And it's a small class, as you can see, but the brethren there are very dear to us, and they do send special greetings as well. The other class we're privileged to meet with, and which we are doing currently during this time, is the Phoenix Associated Bible Students. And it's a much larger class. If all of us are there, it's around 50 brethren. We just had a convention not too long ago, 2 weeks ago. But the brethren there want special love and greetings sent to you, and this is our class. Isaiah 24:19-20 is very descriptive. And it says, the earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently, and it will fall, never to rise again. Boy, if you read that, you're ready to hang it up, aren't you? But it's an important scripture because what we're seeing today, very thing we're praying for. Do you ever think about that? For years and years, the brethren prayed for the Lord's kingdom to come. And now we have to say, whoa, I didn't know it would be coming this fast. But think about it. That's an important self-examination question. We've heard several ideas today about self-examination. Are we ready for the culmination of our hopes? I'm not going to put a date here. Don't look for a date. But I want to sort of recognize this idea that we have of what's going on in a short fashion with the world today to indicate that, yes, the culmination of our prayers and our expectations as far as God's plan is coming along to verify that we have indeed been faithful followers of the Word in examining and understanding what God is bringing to fruition. Zephaniah 3:8 says, therefore wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I rise up as a witness. My decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out on them my indignation, my burning anger. All the earth will be devoured by the fire of my zeal. Notice the underlying words. First thing God does is gather the nations. So we have to understand that nations are very similar. He gathers them together in a way that now he can put those kings together. And when he pours out his indignation, it will have a very significant impact. Notice how he describes that indignation. Burning anger. Well, we know why the Lord is angry. It's not angry in the sense that many think that he's going to cast down fire and brimstone and burn up the earth. But he's taking vengeance for his people, the people that have been persecuted, both his spiritual people and, I believe, his earthly people, the church and Israel. The earth will be devoured. We know, as Bible students, that it's not talking about a literal devouring of the earth, but a devouring of all those things that exist that support the current way of doing things. And why is it? It's God's zeal that does this. So that's the framework that I want to use for this discussion tonight. In an assessment of our time in the harvest, I want to look at 5 different areas. Number 1, unpredictable world leaders. I know what you're thinking. Maybe you're right. Number 2, a China regime regression that is just emerging. 3, the creation of a power vacuum in Europe that's been a stay for centuries and centuries. 4, the growth of extremism throughout the world. 5, the instability of the Middle East, an important segment and perhaps the most telling as we talked about earlier. And six, as a side light, that's why I said five, six, North Korea, which is getting so much today and how that fits in. Because all these are indications of how the Lord is gathering the nations together to fulfill that prophecy that we had in Zephaniah, right? So I start with unpredictable leaders, and of course the first one is unpredictable America. Well, if I show you this picture, I don't think there's anybody in the room that doesn't know who this is. Of course, the United States selected a longtime businessman, Donald Trump, as its president. And we're seeing in the world today what is becoming what I would call the Trump effect. What does that mean? Well, a report in November of 2017 reported it's a Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And it analyzes the news coverage of various leaders. One of the things it did analyze the coverage of the first 100 days in office. Now the president has been in office about over a year. But it bases it on how is the media reporting about this. It incorporates some of the major reporting elements of the world, including Washington Post, CNN, all those broadcasts. To no surprise, unsparing coverage of the United States president has been ultimately negative. There hasn't been one single topic where that coverage was more positive than negative. Now, you may say, well, he deserves it. That's not the point. This is a trend we're seeing across the world, and it's in many world leaders. But it sets a new standard, and it alters the way people in the world are looking at what the role of a powerful nation like the United States has had over the years. Let's expand on that a little more. The changing perception of the role of the United States in overall world policy. This is not going to be a U.S. concentric talk, by the way, but it's important to understand here is the unquestioned world leader as far as driving change in the world now being looked at in a different way. There's no question that the new president in the United States has changed the worldview about the United States. U.S. was always looked at as a stabilizing force. You know, you could head off conflict. It used to be in the old days, remember you had the USSR on one hand and you had the United States on the other side. Think of it as two big battleships out in the ocean, or two huge sumo wrestlers. What do sumo wrestlers do? I mean, they're so big you can't run away from each other. But you circle each other like the battleships, and you just go around. Well, it's pretty easy to avoid conflict, isn't it? And so the U.S. has always been able to head off that conflict because it was a big battleship and there was only one or two others. It's not true anymore. Now that ocean is full of little PT boats, and they're going all over the place, and the danger of a crash is much greater than it was when you had two big battleships. It used to be that that power was used to advance the worldview. Now it's advancing its own interests, a more hawkish kind of foreign policy. So what if we don't avoid war? On top of that, we have unpredictable world leaders. Let me take you on a survey of some of the world leaders you may not think about too much. But here's the status of what we have in the world today. Let me get through this, sorry. The governor of Jakarta, a man who is part of a rock band called Metalhead. He won the Indonesian presidency in 2014. And some of his main things are, this is Joko Widodo. His first video came, or what was he called, a vlog, on his social media accounts and informed the public that he was out there watching the President Cup soccer tournament at a place. And this is his activity. Let me show you what I'm out there doing. Well, that's pretty good for a head of state, isn't it? Just what I want to know. Anyone know who this is? Right, Indian Prime Minister Modi. He has used social media greatly. When you think about President Trump and his tweets getting all kinds of world attention, many of the world leaders are doing exactly the same thing. And I'm going to conclude something about that that's important as we look at the world today. What he announces is new policies. He disseminates press releases. He responds to public complaints on his own social media. If you want to hear what he has to say, you can connect to him. You can connect to him on Twitter, on Facebook. He is the most followed world leader, even more than what the U.S. president, in both Instagram and LinkedIn. Who is this? Angela Merkel, yes. The Chancellor of Germany. She often uses Instagram. How many of you use Instagram? Maybe a few of us, but not much. But she uses it to share her activities and images that are taken by her official photographer. About this one, any Canadian citizens here? Right. Justin Trudeau held a press conference at the National Press Theatre in Ottawa, Ontario, November of 16, became the first politician to host a Snapchat live story. Well, yes, who could miss this person? Vladimir Putin. In Russia, Putin has transformed the leadership into an unpredictable and a very secretive leadership with a very passionate love of power. When you look at the long-term interests of his country, Russia is declining in population. It's declining in revenue because of the oil revenues. 60% of the gross domestic product of Russia is driven by oil revenues. You know what's happening in Saudi Arabia. The same thing is happening in Russia. But Putin is more interested in his own image. Full of anti-democratic beliefs, and as a former KGB agent, more concerned with venerating fear as the instrument for dealing with people and dissent. This one you may not know as well. Deputy Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, the number two person in Saudi Arabia. You know Saudi Arabia has recently opened up the right of women to drive. And that was driven by this number two because he realizes the country needs to come up to date. He's gained enormous clout when his father acceded to the throne and he became the youngest in the world leading a defense ministry. And he's the one that's commanded the war that we've had in Yemen. He's also head of the Economic Council and is managing Saudi Arabia's transition. Yes, they are trying to transition from an oil economy to something more. Very difficult. OPEC, for all practical purposes, is dead. If you recently listened to a discourse by Brother Bob Goodman on the Lord's Great Army, very interesting. He talked about the decline of oil driven by the use of electric and non-oil driving, non-gasoline-bearing cars. This is a trend that we're going to see, and it means a lot for the Middle East, which has always been driven by the oil revenues. This one, not so easy. Poroshenko, Ukraine president, wants to modernize that country. You know, this war in Ukraine has been battling for several years, and is the question, will they fall to the ethnic group or the cultural kin in Russia, or will they cling to what's in Europe? The war in the East is taking a very psychological toll on that country. Even the United States is tired of supporting, even with nothing but words, the desire of the rest of the world to live in freedom. What happens with these kind of unpredictable leaders that I've talked about? Well, it causes a great deal of instability. Think about it. In your own country, who might have been the best prime minister that you ever had to create stability? In our country, we go back to the Lincolns and the Washingtons and those who thrived at building a country where people could be concerned that the country was in their best interests. But international politics today, it's much more volatile than it ever was before because of the unusually wide constellation of leaders known for their erratic behavior. That's a quote from Foreign Affairs, which I think is a very good magazine at assessing the global environment. Henry Kissinger was the Secretary of State. You know, Henry Kissinger was Jewish, but he was really a secular Jew. But he was very, very bright and dealt with a lot of crisis during the time he was Secretary of State. And under the United States Ford administration, he wrote three books that were his memoirs. This is my favorite quote of his assessment of what has happened in the world with leadership. The great statesmen of the past saw themselves as heroes who took on the burden of their society's painful journey from the familiar to the as yet unknown. A modern politician is less interested in being a hero than a superstar. Heroes walk alone. Stars derive their status from approbation. Heroes are defined by inner values. Stars by consensus. When a candidate's views are forged in focus groups and ratified by television anchor persons, insecurity and superficiality become congenital. Isn't that a description of the leadership throughout the world today, driven by the consensus of the people, not what's best or what is going to get me the best press? It's a wonderful assessment of where we are today and what's to be expected as we think about the decline of countries and nations of the world. Let's move on to the regression we now see in China. Again, I could have lumped this with other world leaders, but I think it deserves a status of its own because of the size and the importance of China in the future. China, a non-Christian nation, President Xi Jinping, is gaining new power. Just last October, the Chinese party adopted a principle which is called Xi Jinping thought. That principle is there until 2022. And it elevates him to a level like Mao Zedong. You remember Mao Zedong, one of the worst despots in China. A one-man rule, basically. What's his priority? To overhaul the legal system, to rule by law, to give the state the power to maintain a political, social, and economic control, a foreign policy driven by their own ethno-nationality. Chinese living outside the country, how many are there? 50 million Chinese. Think about that. More than the entire population of Australia, Chinese living outside the country. What he wants to do is align their interests with their home country so that they can not only exhibit control there in China, but also in countries in which they do business. China is investing very big into Africa right now. What's the biggest growing area of the third world is Africa. We're also experiencing today a huge power vacuum now emerging in Europe. You know, a few years ago, we thought that the European nations would come together with the European Union. It would form a new kind of power. And many brethren were very excited about that. We're going to see the rise of Europe again. Not so sure that's going to happen. You know that the breakup of the European Union has started. Those who want it open or closed. There's a great division going on within Europe right now. And although the economies will pull through, there's a lot of pressure being put now on the thing about open borders. What will it mean for the social fabric of Europe? It's not unthought of that the UK, which is already withdrawn, never got into the European currency, and now saying we're going to withdraw, is going to go completely away from Europe and become totally independent again. That's much more likely than what many people realize today. Emmanuel Macron was elected the youngest head of state in France since Napoleon Bonaparte. He beat out his far-right rival, Marine Le Pen, who would have regressed that nation back to very much like you see many others. But again, we're seeing a huge change in the philosophy and leadership in Europe. And today in Spain, we had an exchange student from Spain that was actually had their home back up in Catalonia, in that area. But you've seen what's happened in Spain with the Catalan separates wanting to make an argument that let's pull back from Spain. And you're seeing this desire to divide even within Europe, even though they knew it was going to be a very difficult road. So all across Europe, we see a vacuum building that probably is going to continue for some time. The fourth trend we see, pointing us towards this element of gathering the nations for God's anger to be dumped, is extremism. President of Turkey, Tayyip Erdogan, is pushing for a system run mainly by him rather than parliament. Nicholas talked about the sporting element of Australia. Well, here we have a true sporting element because in Turkey, he's a former semi-pro soccer player that was elected as president. Again, what can I say? We've got a We've got a reality celebrity and a businessman, and you can go across the world. 2,000 prosecutions against people who, quote, insulted him. That's the kind of movement we're seeing there. And it's coming across and across, persecution and silencing to those who are criticizing the leadership. So there's a new war emerging in civilizations. From Europe to North America, we have this whole concept of nativism on the rise. Let's focus on ourselves. We've seen extreme political events and gains in places like Germany, Austria, the Czech Republic, those that we didn't talk so much about. But there's this great new tension that's building around the world. What happened in the U.S. a year ago just added to that movement. It didn't resolve the conflicts like has always been there in the past. So I ask you a question. Does it mean our civilization, the Western civilization, which we're all part of, is it in decline? Well, if the scriptures are to be fulfilled, we know that has to happen. And we're seeing that change and shift in the world with what we've seen in leadership changes. Not going to have time to talk about the other changes that have taken place and the economic changes, the social changes. We'll touch on that. But it's really driven by the leadership. And what is it that gets criticized mainly in scripture? Rather it's in the church or it's in the Jewish systems, it's the leadership that always brings about the wreck, isn't it? And when God says he'll gather nations, it's for that purpose, because the leadership has driven it away from the people. In 1973, there was a novel called The Camp of the Saints. Some of you may have seen it or read it. It was written by a French intellectual, but it really depicted all of Europe being overrun by refugees from the developing world. That was 1973. Are we seeing that happen today? Certainly are, and we're seeing the results of that. 2015, another Frenchman wrote a novel based on this same concept, but he ended it a little differently. He ended it with the installation of the Islamic government in France. I ask you to think about what happens if that comes true. Changes the whole role of extremism in the world. And talk about persecution. Well, if you've followed any countries that go under Sharia law, the law of Islam, you see what happens in a place like Syria or others that institute this fully. So I'm not meaning to scare us, but to say that these are realities in which we live. Both those books blame the collapse, not on those who are coming in. You know, we put the blame on them. We all like to blame them for coming in, but what was it that they really saw was the problem? The cultural, the political, and the business leaders. They wouldn't stand up because of their own interests. There was a declining respect for things like free speech, the importance of citizenship, the weakening of families. And there was an assault on what was called liberalism. Now, this is not liberal, like you think of liberal. But liberalism means that people understand their own business. They understand their own interests better. They care for them more than the government does or can be expected to do. But when we've created a world and a society where entitlement becomes the way of life, no matter where we go across the world, that becomes an issue. Nowhere is this idea more evident than Catholicism. I'm not going to say a lot about religion, but think about, we've had a new pope come in with a distinct philosophy different than was in the past. But has it made a difference? Look at Spain. Spain has had a 10-year drop in Catholicism from 77% of the population to 69% of the population. Marriages that have been performed by the church over a 25-year period across the board has declined from 79% of Catholics had marriages performed by the church. Now it's just 29%. The Pope says to be a Catholic that does not live their faith, it is better to be an atheist. Well, that's a good resolution, isn't it? But we're seeing even with the best effort, people are changing their attitudes towards institutions. We realize that's really what the Lord's great army is about. It's about the people rising up. And anarchy doesn't mean that everyone is beating each other up. True anarchy means people lose faith in their government to help them. And if that's what happens, this is a result we get. They have lost their faith in the church. They have lost their faith in leadership. The Middle East instability is very important to us, of course. In the Middle East, 100 years ago last November, of course, the Balfour Declaration was issued. That upset everything in the Middle East. Very short document, if you read it. It's only the paragraph that is the most crucial, only 67 words in that paragraph. But it really put the teeth in the effort. It never did influence World War I like it was intended to do, but it influenced the Middle East, I think, as God intended it to. And that's what we've seen since then. There's no other place since World War I where the results of what has happened from that Balfour Declaration is as current as they are, is in that Middle East. Nowhere else where the 20th century violence still determines the political conditions. The European Civil War that took place from 1914 onwards, and I think came to an end in 45, I really think those two world wars were one huge civil war in Europe. Cold War, it was over in 1990. But the tensions that came out of World War I on the Arab world in the Middle East, they're still there. If anything, it has grown. The Middle East today is in the kind of same situation as Europe was after World War I, when the Treaty of Versailles was signed. The realities of what the Middle East is pretty much ignored by the world because they're all chasing their own things. Meanwhile, what we expect, the changes in Israel coming. Everyone knows Netanyahu. He's from Philadelphia, or he grew up in Philadelphia, in our home territory, very popular leader of Israel. This is what he said in 2015. He said, "Israel is your home and that of every Jew. Israel is waiting for you with open arms." Let's just take a quick look at the immigration to Israel by country since 1948, when Israel became a nation. You can see here all the countries: Russia, Ukraine, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Romania, Poland, Iraq, the USA, Ethiopia, France, Iran, Argentina. That's just the top 10. Over 2.5 million that have immigrated there since that country opened up its arms. No other place on earth has that happened. This change in our civilization in the West is continuing to drive more and more from Western Europe to Israel. Today, the Jewish policy research said 70% of the European Jews are focused in 6 countries that you see circled here: UK, Germany, France, Spain, Italy, and Belgium. It's clear, it says, that Jews in part of Europe are genuinely concerned about their future, most likely because of anti-Semitism. Think what I told you about what's happened in these countries that have unstable leadership, where we're seeing the growth of Islam and the extremism driving them away. Joel 3 focuses on Israel and its role in the end times. Joel 3, 1 to 12, I'm going to just highlight. It says, "For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem." What does that mean? The captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, not that they're going to be taken captive, but God is going to take them captive. He's going to bring them back to the land. What is happening elsewhere when he does that? The weak say, "I am strong." Who are the weak? It's all those others, the extremists, those that have been minorities for so long are now saying, "I'm strong, I'm going to rise up." Meanwhile, the Lord can bring his people. "All ye heathen." Well, I talked about how we're seeing the decline in religion. We're seeing the growth of those that would be categorized as heathen. "Gather yourselves together." My intent is to gather nations. All these things are to be expected as Israel grows in importance. Well, let's just focus on what it means for Israel. It says, "Those days I will bring the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem." We don't have time to discuss in depth Ezekiel 38, but I think it's been mentioned. Ezekiel 38, I believe, describes the last battle of Israel and that occurs in Israel. When the nations of the world go against Israel. For what purpose? Well, I think there are two purposes that are given here. Those that go against them with a shield and a helmet, and those that are the leading merchants taking a spoil. Two groups, a fighter group in a spoiler group. Today, Syria has experienced 5 years of civil war, a Christian population that's fallen down to 500,000, and Iraq is a similar case. A further element, I believe Syria, those of you that have been to Israel, know right on the tip of the northern Israel, Syria sits. And Israel, I believe, will eventually react to that. But it means that those that are gathered around, Israel will focus on those, and that there will be a continued gathering of those that were, as I said, the fighters and the spoilers, two groups that will gather for the last battle against Israel, while the rest of the world is focused on itself. Why? Because the leadership no longer interferes. Let's look at the last element, which is North Korea. If you're 22 years old and you get to run a country, that's not bad, is it? Kim Un-young, North Korea's weapons development, I think, really is overdone. This family that's ruled in North Korea has been there since 48. This is Kim Un-young as a young man. His father was there, and I think it's unlikely that anything big is going to happen there one way or the other. But it's taking the world's focus off what's going on in other places. That's the important element that we see in all these parts of the world. January 2016, when North Korea had had its fourth test of nuclear things, our president, or then pre-president Trump, said, "This guy doesn't play games, and we can't play games with him because he really does have missiles. And he really does have nukes." He was right. But there's no alternatives there. He's taken the focus off other issues in the world. There's no promise of success there. And I think it's one of those things that just is annoying part of the world that's not going to go away. Well, we could go on and on. I wanted to give you a flavor of what you see happening. And again, barely touched the surface. We could have gone much farther into Ezekiel 38. But that's a whole subject of itself. But keep that in mind as everything is forming outside the world. This silent happening in Israel with the regathering of the people and the continued gathering of those who constitute this group of spoilers and fighters is gathering for that last great battle. Well, what does it mean to us? What should we be doing? How should we think about this? Mark 2:21 says, "No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear results." In its context, I think Jesus was talking about the Pharisees and why he couldn't go through the Pharisees and give them the new way of thinking because they were bottled up in the old ways of the law. But there's a principle involved here that God can't restore what's broken in the world. He removes it all and starts afresh. Doesn't mean things won't go through, but it's a principle that we expect to see a continued decline of the nations of the world as we progress towards the kingdom of God. In volume 4, The Battle of Armageddon, now many of people say, well, it's really outdated. And in many ways, there are things in there that we talk about locomotives versus jet planes. That's true, but there are some key points in there that if you just ignore this, you miss, that I think are very important in helping to explain what goes on, because I think there are some very important points that we're seeing develop today. Number one, the increased ease of life that we've had in our world creates just wider discontent. I don't have enough, and if I have a lot, I still don't have enough. The ease of life created by the way we've invented ourselves almost out of work, just further discontentment. The prospects are even greater. We've replaced the Industrial Revolution with technology. The next group is a professional group. We're all going to be replaced by the huge IBM Watsons, the first element of artificial intelligence. Wealth compounds phenomenally, but it's never enough. Every time we come out and say, well, the rich get rich and the poor get poor, but the poor get richer and the rich get richer. And I remember Brother Carl Hagensick went through all the countries where brethren exist. And he'd say the brethren in the United States are wealthier, the poorest brethren in the United States are wealthier than the richest brethren in this country, and went through them all. And it's true. Wealth is compounding at a fantastic, great. Brother Russell's day, he said it was terrific. Well, it's even 1,000 times more today. But it's never enough, is it? Number three, the ease of the labor burden just produces more hostility between the workers and the owners of production. Number four, increased knowledge. Now think today in terms of social media as the key to increased knowledge that alerts many to what they don't have, creates further discontent. Number five, all nations demand a piece of the pie. Everybody, I went through that list of all those nations, want to be something that they don't have today, including someone like North Korea. Number six, the conflicts between the haves, and let's call them in our today's term, the right, and the have-nots, the left, just continues to increase and broadens the gap. Number seven, I didn't talk about this, but it's a real characteristic. The nation's increased debts lead to bankruptcy. We've had financial panics. We've had defaults. We've had countries like Cyprus. We've had countries like Italy go in tremendous financial crisis. That's the next big element that we expect to see continue. Number eight, a worldwide revolution of the discontent. And I like the term that was used in Volume 4, the real or imagined rights. You know, there are real rights, and there are certainly imagined rights. And unfortunately, we're getting more of those imagined rights. Mainstream religion, and in Volume 4, Brother Russell talks about the beast, the image of the beast, and the false prophet makes a comeback. We haven't seen this yet, but I don't discount anything at this point. I think the world is in a vacuum, and when you got a vacuum, something emerges to fill that vacuum. We'll see what happens. Number 10, the last thing, governments dissolve through overthrow and anarchy. And remember what I said, anarchy really is the lack of faith in government. Jacob's trouble, the final battle of Armageddon. Those are the 10 points. If you don't read Volume 4, those are the 10 key points of Volume 4. And I think it's apropos for our day because these things are real in our midst. Over the past century, we've seen unprecedented social upheaval, economic, political upheaval. No one wants to be oppressed anymore. No oppression of any kind. Anything is not acceptable, no matter what you believe or what your choices are in life. No oppression is acceptable, and everything must be accepted by everyone. The human rights issues, a big dynamic, and it's global. Every country is being hit with these. So we've got this huge, diverse population that's integrated and just raising the level of discontent and protest is global because we now have the access to the kind of ways we need to communicate with each other. The focus on rights around the world has blurred the line between the real human rights and what are the perceived rights. Confusion, chaos. How do you appease all these diverse cultures? Because everybody is now judging themselves by the consensus of the people. We had a book, America, how many of you read Animal Farm? It was a required reading back in school. George Orwell, who was a socialist, or perhaps you'd even say a true communist, wrote Animal Farm. And in it, remember, the animals take over the farm, okay, and they revolt against all their leaders. And they write seven commandments on the side of the barn. It says, this is what we're going to practice, okay, as animals. We're going to make equal rights for everyone. They write these seven commandments. Gradually, one by one, they remove these commandments till only the number seven commandment is left. And it says, all animals are equal. And at the end of the book, an addition is made to number seven. But some animals are more equal than others. Very true in our day, isn't it? Today, all the reforms that we've seen come out of man have been supplanted by moral platforms, all disguised as equality. Today, we are faced with a world that reigns on selfishness, not love. Someone talked about this earlier. The world revolves around me. Malachi 3:15 says, now we call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up, declares the prophet of the Lord. During the past 6,000 years, we've seen that Satan has indeed been able to deceive humans through this principle of selfishness. What is the desire? To be gods of the earth. That's what Satan offered Eve, you will be like God. Brethren, Jesus' kingdom will reverse that order. Love, preference for others, not only will be taught, but it will be rewarded. It won't come suddenly. You know, the millennial age is not an age of blessing as much as it is an age of adjudication, making things right. That's why Isaiah says in 26:9, when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. Not practice it, but learn it. And that new covenant that will be made with Israel will flow to the world. Jeremiah, who describes that earlier in his book, says here, Jeremiah 31:34, they will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. Brethren, we cannot change the hearts of men today. Only those that are truly seeking the Lord will change. But what can we be? We can be ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us to be in 2 Corinthians 5:20. What does that mean? When we go out to the world, we can exhibit our own personal integrity in dealing with other people. We should be objective. We should be independent in discussing the activities of the world. We should be on our watchtower, looking and perceiving what is going on. We should be concerned on an individual level. The opportunities you have to offer individual help and care for those either entrusted to you or those needing you is part of our ambassadorship. Fourth, an ambassador must have an interest in the major problems of their day. You can't just dismiss them, say they mean nothing. These are the things that are pressing on people that you're representing. So we should be a student of prophecy, not a prophet. We should not, the things going on in the world shouldn't be our primary focus. But we must be aware of what's taking place, but not over attentive to it. Luke 21:34, Jesus says, be on guard so your hearts will not be weighted down with dissipation and drunkenness on the worries of life. Boy, that's easy to do today. I spent a great deal of my career as a crisis team participant, and if anything, these are some of the things that you learn. The saturation coverage of events in the news, it's often hyped up. It's nothing but alarmist. It's confusing. It exploits the fears of the people. Many times it's premature, and many times it's wildly inaccurate. Today we have the ability to tune in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Everything is ubiquitous. It's everywhere instantly. And it becomes what I call a cognitive tsunami. It can get into your mind so bad that you can't sleep, you fear what's happening. Don't get caught up into it. Realize we're on that watchtower watching what's happening, and we know the end result. Nothing is bigger in the world today than some kind of a massive terror strike. Don't let it leave you feeling overloaded or scared, baffled, cynical, or even opinionated, belligerently so. It can drive you insane if you let it. Apply skepticism to the most dire predictions and prognosticators, because only you know how it turns out. You ever wash a baby's hair? You wash a baby's hair before the days we had shampoo that wasn't tear-free. Put their head down, the shampoo runs in their eyes, and they get all scared and everything. But if you look up, there's no problem. When you look down, brethren, you're overweight the cares of this life. When you look up, you bring your spiritual awareness. And your focus in life gets refixed. Let's focus our life upward. Let's focus our vision upward so that we can say, as Peter does, according to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. To God be the glory forever and ever. Amen.